Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we are reading from the March 21st, 2025 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week looks like a game show scene. Our MC is a smiling Donald Trump holding the microphone, and his assistant is the new Secretary of Commerce, billionaire Howard Lutnick. They're standing on either side of one of these big wheels that they spin, and the different options on the wheels are more tariffs, lift tariffs, recession, mystery tariffs, stock market crash, double tariffs. And the headline is Wheel of Misfortune. Will Trump and Lutnick's trade wars tank the economy? That is, in fact, our first main story. We will start there. Trump tariffs cause stock market whiplash. What happened? President Trump this week imposed a sweeping 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum imported into the U.S., doubling down on trade policies that have shaken stock markets, alienated allies, and raised fears of an economic downturn. Trump said the tariffs, which apply to both raw materials and the thousands of products made with them, including nuts, bolts, and soda cans, were needed to take back wealth stolen by other countries. Canada, which supplies more of the metals to the U.S. than any other nation, retaliated with 25% tariffs on American steel and aluminum, along with $21 billion in new duties on U.S.-made computers, sports equipment, and other consumer goods. Canada will keep our tariffs on until the Americans show us respect, said the country's new prime minister, Mark Carney. The European Union hit back with a $28 billion in new tariffs on American bourbon, Harley-Davidson motorcycles, and other goods. We deeply regret this measure, said European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, but jobs are at stake. Trump's metal tariffs landed a week after he doubled import duties on Chinese goods to 20% and announced 25% tariffs on all products from Canada and Mexico, claiming the levies were punishment for a lack of action on fentanyl and people smuggling. But after stock markets nosedived, Trump announced a month-long tariff exemption for many Canadian and Mexican goods. Stocks continued to waver despite the pullback. The S&P was down nearly 9% from its February high as the week went to press. But Trump appeared unconcerned and refused to rule out a recession. I hate to predict things like that, Trump said, adding that a period of transition lay ahead. Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers this week forecast a near 50% prospect of recession this year due to Trump administration policies, including tariffs and federal government layoffs. A new CNN poll found that 56% of voters disapprove of Trump's handling of the economy, more than at any point during his first term, and that his overall approval rating is underwater, at about 45%. What the editorial said. Welcome to the dumbest trade war in history, said the Wall Street Journal. North Americans started this week by discovering that Ontario Premier Doug Ford was hiking the price of electricity his province exports to the U.S. Midwest and Northeast by 25% in response to Trump's on-and-off 25% tariffs on Canada. Trump then went ballistic, even by his standards, announcing he'd double his metal tariffs on Canada to 50% unless Canada became our cherished 51st state. Thankfully, both he and Ford backed down. But who knows which side of the tariff bed Trump will wake up on tomorrow. Let's try to make this clear for the man in the Oval Office, said the Chicago Tribune. Tariffs are akin to taxes on Americans. Exporting countries don't foot the bill, which instead is passed along to U.S. consumers in the form of higher prices. Then there's the damage these self-defeating tariffs cause to American exporters. The U.S. shipped $763 million worth of spirits, wine, and beer to Canada last year. But now the state-run liquor stores across our northern border are removing American products from their shelves. That's how trade wars go. Our one side acts, the other reacts, and then the original side reacts to that. We all lose. What the columnist said. Despite the investor freakout, it's way too early to say the economy is destined for a recession, said Matt Egan in CNN.com. The U.S. added a healthy 151,000 jobs last month, and inflation ticked up only 0.2% from January. Still, there is a risk that the market turmoil spills over into the real economy. Consumer confidence, already sinking in recent months, could dip even more as Americans tune in to the market news. It's possible the Trump administration could talk the country into a literal vivisection, said Annie Lowry in The Atlantic. Consumers are still struggling with high prices, and credit card debt and default rates are rising. Hearing Trump talk about a period of transition and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent about a detox period might lead a family to put off buying a new car or quit ordering pizza on Fridays. A downturn could result, or, because tariffs are inflationary, a period of stagflation, in which prices rise but the economy fails to grow. It's as if Trump doesn't understand why he was elected, said Charles C.W. Cook in National Review. Voters fed up with Democrats' mismanagement of the economy wanted him to bring back 2019, a time when the economy was humming, inflation was low, and the border was less chaotic. They overwhelmingly opposed tariffs and are hardly likely to support an endless game of red light, green light that tanks their 401k. Trump's Washington acolytes may feel compelled to defend him at all cost, but ordinary Americans will rebel at being conned. Gone are the days when any high school graduate could tell you that tariffs are a terrible idea, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times, or when policymakers understood that it's the height of foolishness to pick fights with your most reliable trading partners, only to backtrack and create a zero predictability business environment. But we now live in the Trump era where the president's terrible ideas are made real by a team of enablers and toadies. Democracy may die in darkness, but under Trump, it's just as liable to die in dumbness. Controversy of the week. Resistance. How should Democrats oppose Trump? The reviews are in, said Ellie Quinlan Hootailing in the New Republic. And the so-called resistance to President Trump's second term is officially a flop. A new poll from Blueprint, a liberal research firm, found that 40% of registered voters think the Democratic Party doesn't have any strategy at all for opposing Trump, while another 24% believe Democrats do have a strategy, but it's not working. Only 10% think the party has a good strategy. What's even more depressing is that this poll was taken before Trump's speech to Congress last week. While Trump boasted and lied, Democrats expressed their opposition with a confused series of gestures. Texas Representative Al Green, 77, shouted, "No mandate," and waved his cane, which got him escorted from the House chamber and, this week, censured by his colleagues, while other lawmakers held up small signs bearing slogans such as "Musk steals" and Save Medicaid. Senator Alyssa Slotkin, Democrat from Michigan, tried to sound modest and patriotic, delivering the Democratic response, said Matthew Cottonetti in National Review. She calmly denounced Elon Musk and called for fixing the broken immigration system. But the stark contrast with Green's hysterical display only served to showcase Democrats' existential identity crisis. The party has no power, no leader, no coherent plan to take on Trump, and no path out of the wilderness. The smartest thing Democrats can do now is roll over and play dead, said James Carville in the New York Times. They lack the votes to block Trump's agenda, and last week's pathetic displays only made the party look weak. Far better to sit back, stay quiet, and let Trump, Musk, and the most incompetent cabinet in modern history remind voters of Democrats' relative sanity, moderation, and competence. It won't take long. Grocery prices are up, stock market's down, and Trump's approval rating is underwater in new polls, with about 53% of voters disapproving of his performance. Democrats should commit to a tactical pause until that number hits the high 50s, then rouse themselves and go for the jugular. This is horrible advice, said Norman J. Orstein in The New Republic. We're in the headlong rush to autocracy that requires Democrats to use the Senate filibuster and every other tool in the rule book to obstruct and delay Trump. Democrats in Washington may be powerless, said Perry Bacon Jr. in the Washington Post. But there are 23 Democratic governors and 15 states under full Democratic control that could mount a better resistance by opposing Trump's agenda at a local level. They should treat Texas Governor Greg Abbott as a model and study how the Republican whipped up popular opposition to President Biden's immigration policies by sending the National Guard to the border and busing undocumented migrants to blue cities. Attention is everything, said Peter Hamby in Puck News. November's drubbing taught Democrats two key lessons. First, that they have to drop the alienating progressive pieties. Second, that MAGA is beating them badly in the new media battle for eyeballs and engagement. California Governor Gavin Newsom, at least, has heeded both lessons. In the debut episode of his podcast last week, the perfectly coiffed governor agreed with his guest, the ultra-MAGA activist Charlie Kirk, that it's deeply unfair to let transgender girls compete in high school sports. Newsom himself has cringe tendencies that probably rule him out as his party's savior, said Lauren Egan in The Bulwark, but he has the right idea. Until Democrats find their footing in modern media, they have no realistic hope of resisting Trump's agenda, an agenda so destructive that not trying isn't an option. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for making waves after photographers in Hawaii captured the first known image of two humpback whales having sex, both of them males. It's not what I was expecting, said marine biologist Stephanie Stack. It was a good week for Molly Malone after reports that the Dublin City Council is strongly considering a plan to elevate a statue of the iconic Irish seafood vendor to keep locals from kissing or rubbing her breasts for good luck. These misogynistic rituals are all inappropriate, said Tilly Cripwell, organizer of the Leave Molly M. Alone campaign. It was a good week for news after a dog shot a man in Tennessee, as well as clearing the journalistic threshold for general newsworthiness. The incident in which the dog's paw became entangled in a gun's trigger assembly also meets the lighthearted requirements of offbeat news, because the victim was merely grazed in the humorous-sounding left thigh. But it was a bad week for starving artist after Hunter Biden revealed that demand for his paintings has cratered since his father left the White House. In the 2 to 3 years prior to December 2023, I sold 27 pieces of art at an average price of $54,481. Biden, 55, said in a court filing, since then, I have only sold one piece of art for $36,000. It was a bad week for literacy after a religious painting bearing the commandment, "Thou shalt not steal," was stolen from a church in England. Obviously, it doesn't make you feel good, said church warden Basil Harwood. And it was a bad week for consolation prizes after Russia's ruling party marked International Women's Day by gifting an electric meat grinder to the mother of a soldier killed in Ukraine. Although Russia's casualty indifferent military tactics are often likened to a meat grinder, the party asked the public not to support provocative interpretations of this practical gift. Here's a short and other news piece. Trump administration guts education department. The Trump administration this week said it was cutting the education department's workforce by about half, firing more than 1,300 employees, while other staffers accepted buyouts or deferred resignation offers. Of the department's 4,133 employees, only 2,183 will remain after this round of cuts, buyouts, and resignations. Every aspect of the department's work, which includes enforcing civil rights laws in schools, tracking student achievement, and managing federal loans for colleges, will be affected. Key regional centers for the department's Office of Civil Rights will be shuttered. President Trump is reportedly preparing to sign an executive order that would call on Education Secretary Linda McMahon to shutter the department. Any attempt to fully dismantle the agency would require congressional approval and is unlikely to pass the closely divided Senate. This week's briefing is titled, Killer Space Rocks. The threat to Earth from a newly discovered asteroid has faded. Others could be headed our way. What was the recent scare? It was from a football field-sized asteroid designated 2024YR4. Detected in December by a telescope in Chile, the space rock was flagged for its size. It's 130 to 300 feet long, big enough to wipe out a city, and a trajectory that put it on track to possibly hit Earth on December 22, 2032. NASA initially put the chance of an impact at 1.2%. The odds soon jumped to 3.1%, or 1 in 32. A record high for an asteroid of its size. But after closer study of the asteroid's orbit, the threat of a hit was downgraded to a negligible 0.004%. While humanity's plans for the 2032 holidays are safe, the scare highlighted a threat the scientists say urgently needs more focus. The millions of giant rocks that are hurtling through space, some of which may be on collision courses with our planet. Take it as a warning shot across our bow, said astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. These things are out there. How many space rocks pose a risk? NASA's Center for Near-Earth Objects Studies, CNEOS, tracks more than 37,000 asteroids whose trajectories approach Earth's orbit. Most are the size of a car or smaller and pose no risk because they will burn up in our atmosphere. On the opposite end of the spectrum are planet killers, asteroids a kilometer or more across that could potentially wipe out civilization. About 900 have been identified. In between are a range of potential threats. A 160-foot-wide asteroid could destroy a major metropolitan area. Those are thought to strike once every 1,000 years. A 500-foot-wide space rock could inflict mass casualties across a state or small country. Those arrive every 20,000 years. Of course, these numbers are very approximate, said planetary geologist Gordon Osinski, and they don't really help us figure out when the next one might happen. When did the last big one hit? On February 15, 2013, a roughly 60-foot-wide asteroid entered the atmosphere and exploded 19 miles above the Russian city of Chelyabinsk. It set off a blinding flash and a shockwave that damaged more than 7,000 buildings over 200 square miles and injured more than 1,600 people, many of them hit by shattered glass. The light from the blast was like the end of the world, said Valentina Nikolayeva, a teacher. In 1908, a 130-foot-wide asteroid or comet, the latter is an icy ball of dust and rock, exploded 6 miles above a remote stretch of Siberia, releasing 185 times more energy than the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Some 800 square miles of forest were leveled in the so-called Tunguska event. Still, that space rock was a pebble compared with the one that wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. There's no current fear of anything of that magnitude hitting the Earth, but other Tunguska-sized threats are out there. Can they be stopped? Possibly, but first we have to see them coming. In 2005, Congress directed NASA to find and track by 2020 90% of near-Earth objects, asteroids or comets, that come within 30 million miles of our planet's orbit, 460 feet or larger. Right now, we're at something like 45%, said CNOS Director Paul Chodes. NASA has built a network of telescopes, including the one in Chile that detected 2024 YR4, to identify threats. An infrared space telescope, NEO Surveyor, that will further boost detection is scheduled for launch in 2027. When a new object is found, information is shared with a global web of space agencies and observatories that go to work determining its shape, size, and orbital path. If one is judged to be headed for Earth, the next task is to try to alter its path, something NASA recently proved feasible. How did NASA do that? In 2022, it launched the golf cart-sized Double Asteroid Redirection Test, DART, spacecraft, which slammed into Dimorphos, a 530-foot asteroid, at 14,000 miles per hour. The collision successfully altered the projectile's orbit. Researchers are also studying the use of a gravitational tractor, a spacecraft that would orbit alongside an asteroid, exerting gravitational pull that would gradually alter the rock's course. All these efforts require years of advanced planning and may not be effective against a giant asteroid. If a space rock is too large for deflection or due to hit with relatively short notice, humanity would need to use a nuclear bomb to deflect or vaporize it. A 2021 study showed that a 1-megaton nuke launched at least 2 months before impact could annihilate a 330-foot asteroid. But setting off a nuke in space is no small matter. It could be very awkward geopolitically, said Robin George Andrews, author of How to Kill an Asteroid. It's just one example of how asteroid response requires a globally coordinated effort. Are countries working together? We're making progress. The Chelyabinsk explosion led to the creation of NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office, designed in part to link efforts with other groups such as the UN-sponsored International Asteroid Warning Network. And last year, for the first time, international representatives attended NASA's biennial Planetary Defense Interagency Tabletop Exercise, which gamed out the discovery of a massive asteroid with a 72% chance of impacting Earth in 2038. Scientists say this cooperation is a step in the right direction, but that many questions remain around a potential global asteroid defense. What's the best approach? Who would be in charge? Asteroid impacts are one of the few natural disasters that we actually have the means to both foresee and prevent, said NASA aerospace engineer Brent Barbie. We must be as prepared as possible. Why the impact zone matters. Some 66 million years ago, an asteroid at least 6 miles wide slammed into Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Digging a crater 125 miles wide, it triggered earthquakes and tsunamis and firestorms that may have spanned the globe. Gas, soot, and dust blanketed the planet, blotting out the sun and sending global temperatures plummeting. That extinction event wiped out 75% of life on Earth, including the dinosaurs. But some experts believe the impact would have been far less calamitous if the rock had landed elsewhere. A 2017 study concluded that the asteroid struck a spot unusually rich in organic sediment, which worsened the blackout effect. The dinosaurs might have survived if not for that happenstance, the researchers believe, and the rise of the mammals, including humans, might never have occurred. This is maybe a lucky coincidence that everything came into place like it is today, said geochemist Mario Fischer-Gould. And we'll read a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. DOGE takes aim at the air traffic control system. Just one day after 67 people died when an American Airlines passenger jet collided with a U.S. Army helicopter in Washington, D.C., said Isaac Stanley Becker, FAA employees received an email advising they take a buyout. Hundreds, including about 100 air traffic controllers, reportedly said yes to the offer from Elon Musk's DOGE team. After a panicked Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy objected, the FAA later clarified that air traffic controllers could not accept the buyout. But DOGE's downsizing of the FAA has claimed hundreds of aviation safety technicians, engineers, and aeronautical information specialists. Insiders say morale at the agency is at an all-time low, and the workforce is completely distracted by chaos and uncertainty. Personnel cuts aren't the only cause for concern. The FAA's $2.4 billion billion-dollar contract with Verizon to modernize its communications infrastructure is now in limbo, as Musk ignores a massive conflict of interest by pushing for his company, Starlink, to take over some aspects of the crucial air traffic control system, which guides more than 45,000 flights and 2.9 million passengers every day. This isn't Twitter, a former FAA senior executive says. People die when FAA workers are distracted and processes are broken. The military's frantic retreat from diversity. The name of the plane that dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima has been flagged for removal from the Defense Department database, said Amanda Marcotte. Why? Because it was the Enola Gay, and gay is a new verboten word. It's a comical example of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's obsessional efforts to scrub as many as 100,000 posts and images from online military records of references to gay, diversity, gender, tributes to a pioneering women and black and Hispanic soldiers, and anything else he considers woke. Hegseth, a Christian nationalist, belongs to a far-right church that teaches that women should be subordinate to men and that slavery was a benign institution. His own army career was sidelined after superiors discovered he had white supremacist symbols as tattoos, so his attack on woke is personal. He's remaking the military so that straight white Christian men hold all the power, firing multiple black and women generals and leaders, ordering all trans soldiers to be kicked out, and restoring the names of military bases named after Confederate generals. Sadly, the U.S. military is now under siege from the extremist ideologue who's inside the wall. This column comes from Egypt. Arab sheikhs could save Gaza. The sight of a few hundred Palestinians gathered last week in war-wrecked Gaza for the first iftar meal of Ramadan was moving to many Arabs, said Farouk Jawadi. These oppressed people had lost everything, were greeting one another on the ruins of their demolished houses, sharing dishes somehow rustled up. It's a wonder they were able to muster a feast, with Israel shamefully blocking deliveries of food, water, and medicine. But where are the wealthy Muslims? Why aren't they helping these people? Arabs in other countries, safe and comfortable far from the fighting, should be setting up charity funds to make sure Palestinians are properly fed and nursed back to health. Instead, they simply shake their heads and condemn Israel for its brutal aggression. The Palestinians are our fellow Muslims, and their children are starving and freezing. How are we not mobilizing en masse to clothe and feed them, to rebuild their shattered homes? At any time of year, but especially at Ramadan, Muslims everywhere should open their hearts and wallets to share what they have to show solidarity with Gaza. The world stands in amazement as Gazans cheat death, defending the land and clinging to life. But they don't need us to stand by and pity them. They need us to help them. Let the image of iftar be a message to a world that has lost its mercy. And the last word, our in-depth article, fearing vaccines more than viruses. A measles outbreak in West Texas has killed one child and sickened dozens more, said Finnett Nerapil and Elena Gordon in the Washington Post. Many residents are still unwilling to vaccinate. Seminole, Texas. When the local hospital warned of a brewing measles outbreak, Kaylee Brantner urged fellow residents of this rural West Texas community to beware of vaccinating their children. 2 weeks later, her unvaccinated 7-year-old son came home from school with a fever. The telltale rash across his body followed, but his mild symptoms and swift recovery only hardened Brantner's anti-vaccination convictions. Even after an unvaccinated child died of measles at a hospital 80 miles away. We're not going to harm our children or risk the potential to harm our children, she said, so that we can save yours. The measles eruption that started in Seminole has surged to more than 200 known cases and has been linked to 2 deaths. The 6-year-old child in Texas and an adult, also unvaccinated, across the border in New Mexico. The true number of cases is likely much higher, exposing how under-vaccinated communities are unnecessarily vulnerable to one of the world's most contagious diseases, experts say. The life-threatening outbreak in West Texas starkly illustrates the stakes of slipping immunization rates and the ascension of vaccine skeptics, including Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr., to the highest levels of the public health establishment. And it has revealed how fear and the scientifically false claims of the anti-vaccine movement have seeped into communities such as Gaines County, the epicenter of the outbreak, hardening attitudes about vaccines, pro and con, in the face of dangerous, preventable disease. Brattner, 34, said she decided not to vaccinate her children after years of her own research and because, she said, her nephew had a severe reaction to the vaccine against diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. She moved from New Mexico to Texas in part because it's easier here to claim an exemption to school vaccine mandates. A cough, runny nose, fever, and rash to a healthy child is mild, but vaccine adverse reactions are severe, she commented on January 30th on the local hospital's Facebook post, which described measles symptoms. Brantner's son, Paxton, recovered from measles with little problems, she said, after she fed him organic food and cod liver oil, bathed him in magnesium salts, and rubbed him in beef tallow cream infused with lavender. The family took precautions to protect others in the community, such as ordering groceries for pickup and keeping their oldest son out of school. He developed a measles rash Friday. The origins of the outbreak remain unclear. Infections quickly spread within Gaines County's Mennonite community, a diverse religious sect of thousands, some of whom educate their children at home or at private schools without vaccine mandates. But the outbreak is no longer concentrated just in that group. It has infected people like the Brantner family, who are not Mennonites, spread across 9 West Texas counties, and crossed the border into New Mexico. The outbreak spurred hundreds in the region to vaccinate themselves and their children as the threat of the virus became immediate. But it has made others dig in their heels, arguing that measles is no worse than chickenpox or the flu. While most children with measles recover, as many as 1 in 20 develop pneumonia, according to the CDC. 1 in 1,000 experience swelling of the brain, which can leave a child deaf or with an intellectual disability. For every 1,000 children with measles, 1 or 2 die. Still, some living with the outbreak argue that it is a good thing. Girls can grow up and pass antibodies to their children to shore up protection in infancy, while infecting children gain lifelong immunity. But doctors warn that comes at a cost. They could have had that same immunity with the vaccine, said Tammy Camp, a Lubbock pediatrician who oversees doctors who cared for the child who died. And unfortunately, there's a child who paid a very heavy price for that. Conditions were ripe for a regional measles outbreak in Gaines County. It has Texas' third highest rate of public school children, 13.6%, whose parents claim a conscientious exemption for at least one vaccine. In one tiny school district, nearly half the students claim an exemption. In local private schools, officials believe the unvaccinated rate is also high. Measles spreads with extraordinary efficiency, hanging in the air for hours even after a carrier leaves a room. That's why public health experts say a population needs at least a 95% vaccination rate to achieve herd immunity. The disease was eliminated in the United States in 2000, but periodically reemerges after an unvaccinated person travels to a country where measles still broadly circulates. There have been recent cases in the Seattle area, New Jersey, and Southern California. If vaccination rates are high, it's like throwing a match into soaked wood. It fizzles out. If it infiltrates a community with pockets of unvaccinated people, it's like throwing a torch into a parched forest and igniting a wildfire. Measles outbreaks often link back to tightly knit groups with below average vaccination rates, even if the majority of the community is immunized. In 2017, measles tore through a Somali community in the Minneapolis area, infecting more than 70. The next year, a measles outbreak in New York City infected more than 600 Orthodox Jews. Disease detectives are seeing similar conditions among the West Texas Mennonites. The spotlight on Mennonites has bred resentment in the community that they are being unfairly blamed, stereotyped as insular or conflated with subsets of Amish people who eschew modern medicine and technology. Mennonites, descendants of persecuted European Anabaptists, have roots in the community that stretch back to the 1970s when hundreds immigrated from Mexico. Their more than half dozen churches range from sprawling halls where hundreds pack the pews and services are live streamed to tiny buildings on the outskirts of town. Some are recognizable by their language, Low German, or the head covering some women wear, but many are indistinguishable from other residents. They work as baristas, staff home-style cooking joints, and run construction companies, sometimes wearing traditional clothing. Jake Fair, pastor of the Mennonite Evangelical Church, who wore jeans and a blazer as he delivered a sermon about the dangers of anger, said Mennonite clergy do not use their pulpits to dissuade parishioners from getting vaccines. People base their decisions on their own convictions, he said, which range from skepticism of big pharma to a preference for natural immunity. It is not a matter of religion, said Fair, who noted that he and his four children are vaccinated. This gets pushed as a narrative that we are not taking good health protocols and that we are sort of these anti-vaccine people. And that's just simply not the case. He and other local leaders said a Mennonite school and daycare deserve credit for temporarily closing after measles exposures, as do parents willing to abide by the 21-day isolation guidance for unvaccinated children who have been exposed to the virus. Tina Siemens, a local Mennonite historian and author, described the ongoing measles outbreak as just another trial endured by a resilient group. It's not like, oh, we're so anxious, this is an outbreak. We got to really be scared, Siemens says. You work through it, and you learn from your hardships, and you get stronger because of it. Zach Holbrooks, executive director of South Plains Public Health District, which include Gaines County, recently visited Siemens at the museum she runs to share a medical journal article about the 4 months it took to end a measles outbreak in an Amish community in Ohio in 2014. Some Mennonites have faulted him for singling out their community, but Holbrooks said he is just trying to provide information about the burgeoning risk. He worries that younger generations do not understand the danger of measles that he and his staff are now seeing. At a testing site outside the hospital, a mother showed up with a baby with blue lips, a sign the infant was struggling to breathe. That has haunted me, Holbrook said. That would be the impetus for me to do everything I can to get the message about measles vaccine. Vaccines can be a victim of their own success. When diseases vanish, the memory of their dangers and the urgency to eradicate them fade. Marina Tovar brought her 15-month-old daughter, Cambry, to be vaccinated at the Lubbock Health Department after Sunday church services. She had already planned to vaccinate her daughter when the family's insurance plan restarted, but sped up her plans after reading about the outbreak. "Why would I chance her getting it?" Tovar said, noting that her two older children received vaccines, and they've been fine. So we just wanted to keep her protected the best we could. But firsthand experience does not always change views on vaccines. On a morning last week at a Mennonite-owned pizzeria, a Mennonite couple told a waitress that their 16-year-old son's recent bout of measles was minor. "It was a rough couple of days, but nothing worse than a flu," the father, Peter, said. In an interview, the couple said they view childhood vaccination as tantamount to Russian roulette because of the risk of side effects. They spoke on the condition that their last names not be published because, they said, local Mennonites have been harassed and ostracized over the outbreak. The couple said those who choose not to vaccinate children are unfairly vilified. They said they protected the community by keeping their son and his older siblings home after he tested positive for measles. "Some people have it really bad, but most people don't. Just like with the vaccine," said Mary, the mother. "Where there is risk, there should be a choice." Experts say the choice not to immunize has consequences for the community, even when people experience mild illness and isolate once sick. People infected with measles can transmit the virus 4 days before the rash appears. Infants are too young to be vaccinated. Still, some here believe the vaccines themselves are responsible for the rapid spread of the virus. They repeated false claims from anti-vaccine activists outside Texas who blamed free vaccine clinics launched in the early days of the outbreak for accelerating infections. They have seized on a handful of measles cases in vaccinated patients. As of last week, 5 patients who contracted measles are known to have been vaccinated, to argue that the unvaccinated are not to blame. But epidemiologists say it's not surprising that occasional infections will occur among vaccinated people when an outbreak is rapidly growing. Ben Edwards, a physician in Lubbock who treats some patients in Seminole, including a family with measles, recently released an episode of his podcast about the outbreak, in which he described mass infection as God's version of measles immunization. Edwards said the ideal treatment for measles is not all that dissimilar from other infectious diseases. His advice for patients is to undergo a mitochondrial tune-up to strengthen their immune response. Go get a green juice or just drink some water with a pinch of sea salt and go sit outside and listen to a bird chirp, Edwards said. It sounds crazy, but it's the basics. It's what our ancestors knew. His views stand in stark contrast with the pleas of those on the front lines of the outbreak to get vaccinated. All 20 confirmed measles patients are treated at Covenant Children's Hospital in Lubbock were unvaccinated, officials said. Summer Davies, a pediatric hospitalist, has cared for about half of them, including the child who died. This is a disease they don't have to get if they have adequate vaccination or if we had adequate herd immunity, Davies said. Knowing there was a way to prevent it is the heartbreaking part. This story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Couple of short health and science pieces. Weight training for insomnia. Those over 60 who struggle to get to sleep should try doing resistance training during the day. That's the conclusion of a meta-analysis of more than 25 studies involving data from 2,170 people. Some 12% to 20% of seniors suffer from insomnia, and at least twice as many report feeling sleepy during the day. That can have knock-on effects on health. Sleeplessness has been linked to depression, anxiety, and other conditions. The research found that all forms of exercise, aerobic, strengthening, and a combination of the two, resulted in better sleep, but that strength training by itself was the best. Weight training also carries a lower risk of injury, in particular from a fall, than more intense workouts. Sleep experts say the link between weights and better rest makes intuitive sense. Sleep is essentially recovery for wear and tear on the body, said Jade Wu, founder of Thrive Sleep Clinic in Durham, North Carolina. Resistance training puts literal wear and tear on muscles, so sleep is needed to repair and grow those muscles. Next stop, mammoths. Scientists hoping to bring some version of the woolly mammoth back from extinction have successfully genetically engineered mice to grow a woolly coat fit for the Stone Age. The team at Dallas-based Colossal Biosciences identified the genes that made mammoths distinctive by comparing ancient samples of their DNA to the genetic sequences of their closest living relatives, African and Asian elephants. Mammoth traits included not only woolly hair, but also a way of metabolizing fat that helped the beast survive the cold. The researchers then found and tweaked the corresponding genes in mice and implanted altered embryos into females. We ended up with some absolutely adorable mice, Beth Shapiro, the company's chief science officer, tells NPR.org. This is really validation that what we have in mind for our longer-term de-extinction project is really going to work. The aim now is to use the same technique on elephants themselves, with the goal, if all goes well, of producing the first mammoth-like calves by 2028. And as usual, we'll finish out on the Talking Points page. We have an article here. SCOTUS, a glimmer of independence? The Supreme Court has proved its mettle in its first important confrontation with the Trump administration. Barely, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg. Last week, the court ruled 5-4 that President Trump cannot freeze $2 billion in U.S. aid payments to U.S. contractors who had already completed their work before he took office. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett sided with the three liberal justices to affirm a district court's order that the Trump administration must make the payments immediately. In doing so, they effectively repudiated Trump's unlawful executive order that froze all foreign aid spending in January. That sends the important message that the Trump administration can't end run the existing legal order to do whatever it wants. But the bad news is that the other four conservative justices dissented, thus signaling to Trump that they're willing to side with him in his unlawful behavior, no matter how extreme. The other important news is that the Supreme Court's six conservatives are not an ideological monolith, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The court is far from predictable. Barrett's willingness to stand up to Trump earned her vitriolic denunciations from the angry MAGA camp, who denounced her appointment to the court as a DEI hire and a mistake. I think Barrett was wrong in this case, said Charles C.W. Cook in National Review, but she is a terrific justice and a true originalist whose opinions brim with intelligence, independence, and nuance. The claim that she must automatically vote in favor of the president who appointed her strikes me as corrupt. Perhaps her critics have forgotten the proper role of the judiciary. But will Barrett and Roberts consistently stand as a bulwark against Trump's authoritarian power grab? Asked Nicholas Bagley in The Atlantic. That's unclear. Although the two justices sided with the liberals in this case, their ruling was narrow and based on technicalities and did not explicitly repudiate Trump's assertion that he has the constitutional authority to impound federal dollars and ignore Congress' spending commands. That claim will be tested again in a much broader way in the near future, as Trump seeks unilateral power to gut agencies and run the government as if it were his private fiefdom. If he can get a fifth vote from the Supreme Court, expect him to exercise that power again and again and again. And we'll run through some of the shorter notes. Numerous staffers at Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency are drawing six-figure government salaries. Jeremy Lewin, a Doge employee tasked with slashing U.S. aid, is making about $167,000 a year. Kyle Schutte, a software engineer, gets $195,200 a year, the maximum for any general schedule employee. When Musk began recruiting for Doge, he claimed new hires would get zero compensation. As the price of eggs has spiked, customs officials say, more people are trying to smuggle eggs into the U.S. Customs and Border Protection reported a 29% increase in egg seizures at all ports of entry from October to February, compared with a year earlier. At CBP's San Diego field office across the border from Tijuana, egg interceptions are up 158%. The Department of Homeland Security spent $30,000 to air TV ads in Florida's West Palm Beach market, thanking President Trump for his immigration crackdown. The ads aired from February 25th through March 5th. Trump visited his Mar-a-Lago residence in West Palm Beach during that period. Before Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was publicly berated in the Oval Office by President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance, polls showed that he was trusted by 57% of Ukrainians. After the White House clash, Zelensky's trust rating in Ukraine climbed to 67%. On the poll watch, 5 years after the COVID pandemic began, 47% believe their life has returned to normal. But 40% think life will never get back to normal. 72% reported having contracted COVID, while 28% say they never had the viral illness. 11% said they had experienced long COVID symptoms that lasted 3 months or more. 58% are worried about another pandemic in their lifetimes. We've got two quotes to finish the show. Warren Buffett says, "Trust is like the air we breathe. When it's present, nobody really notices. When it's absent, everybody notices." And comedian Fred Allen, quoted in the Iredell Free Press, says, "I like long walks, especially when they are taken by people who annoy me." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, we thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.